On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Barack Obama ran for the presidency, he tapped into a deep vein of American unease over the way the Bush administration had been running its war on terror, the waterboarding, the targeted killing, assassinations, Guantanamo Bay, and military tribunals. This president promised to do right by the Constitution and our consciences. 3 years in, many see key controversial elements of Bush-era practice still in place, up to and including targeted killing, even of Americans. Last week, President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder laid out the case for Obama policy. This hour, On Point, the Constitution, targeted killings, and Obama's war on terror. You can join the conversation. From Guantanamo to drone strikes, do you see a stay-the-course policy from Bush to Obama in the war on terror? Do you see due process? Do you want to constrain presidential power? Do you want to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We are going to hear some, I'm guessing, tough debate this hour about what's legal and what's right and what's happening. With me in the studio and chomping at the bit maybe, is Jack Goldsmith. He was in the Bush Department of Justice, and he thinks a kind of ecosystem of constraint has grown up around the president. But we're going to go first today to Anthony Romero to fire the opening salvo. He is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU's national head. He joins us from New York. Anthony Romero, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What did you think of the Attorney General's defense of Obama policy in the war on terror last week? This was at Northwestern University Law School outside Chicago.
Well, it was a very disturbing and very disappointing speech. There were segments of the speech, of course, that no one can argue with. The fact that we need to retain our values, we need to retain a focus on what makes America a great democracy. There was good rhetoric in the speech, and unfortunately, some of the details around the rhetoric, especially in the middle, were very troubling. And perhaps most troubling of all is the fact that these arguments, now articulated by our Attorney General Eric Holder under the administration of President Barack Obama, establish a new normal. This is much the same, frankly, Tom. There's been very little difference. This is where Jack Goldsmith and I coincide completely in some of the analysis in his book, which is terrific. I've had a chance to read an advanced copy of it. There are very few differences. There are some. They're notable. They're worthy of note. For instance, Obama banned the use of torture and reestablished what was a longstanding prohibition against the use of torture practices in interrogation. We should never have gone there to begin with. But frankly, when you look at the actual changes in the policies in military commissions, in detention issues and questions around Guantanamo, there's been very little change. And you see the rhetoric from the Attorney General as very, very troubling. I mean, there are parts of it that just, they could have been reminiscent of Attorney General Mukasey or Attorney General Gonzalez or Attorney General Ashcroft, for that matter.
I'd like to look in particular at the targeted killing issue, because drone strikes have been very actively, of course, pursued in the Obama administration. And the drumbeat in advance of this speech was, we're going to lay out the legal argument for what's going on here. Jonathan Turley listened to the speech along with a lot of others, and his headline is, you know, "Trust us," Attorney General Eric Holder says, "we'll only assassinate Americans after administrative, quote-unquote, due process, not judicial." Turley says, "that's not how the Constitution works, buddy." That's his response.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree with much of Mr. Turley's analysis. Sometimes he's a bit flamboyant in his criticism, but I think that the nuggets are certainly there. I mean, first off, the section that was for me the most troubling is the one that Jonathan points to. I mean, the Attorney General at one point says, quote, "some have argued that a president is required to get permission from a federal court before taking action against a United States citizen who is a senior operational leader of Al-Qaeda or associated forces." This is simply not accurate. Due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. The Constitution guarantees due process, not judicial process, end quote. Now, that is breathtaking. How can we argue that a real system of due process exists when you want to write out the judiciary. I don't know, in my little law school at Stanford Law School, I learned that due process is the place, it's the concept that's adjudicated by the courts. The idea that the executive branch on its own can be judge, jury, and executioner and provide due process without a judicial branch totally undoes the system of checks and balances. The whole premise of the Hamiltonian system of checks and balances, that we have co-equal branches of government serving as a check on the other. And the reason why you need them is because you want to make sure that that excess deposited in one branch of government does not grow amok. And the idea that then we can have due process, but we'll do it in the executive branch. We don't need the courts. We don't need judges. We don't need oversight. It's just startling. I would love to know what law professor would teach his students in Con Law 1 that due process is completely separate and apart from the judicial process.
Well, President Obama was a constitutional law professor, so maybe he's the one.
Well, I think he's become the president. So the good old days of being a con law professor, obviously it's quite a different gestalt for the Obama White House at the moment.
Anthony Romero, stand by for just a moment. I would like to hear with you just a little bit of the Attorney General's speech. And again, this was at Northwestern University Law School.
Sure.
Here he is saying that the Constitution gives the president extraordinary powers in time of war. Are we now at war? Are we in perpetual war? Holder says we're at war now.
The Constitution empowers the president to protect the nation from any imminent threat of violent attack. And international law recognizes the inherent right of national self-defense. None of this is changed by the fact that we are not in a conventional war.
Not a conventional war, he said, but war. And then this reference, last September, U.S. drones killed the American cleric Anwar al-Awlaki in a remote corner of Yemen. People in this country and around the world were in an uproar over whether a government has a right to assassinate one of its citizens without trial, much less conviction of a crime. Now, of course, al-Awlaki was said to be part of an operational part of al-Qaeda in Yemen, linked to al-Qaeda, of course. And here was the Attorney General again last week saying, don't call it an assassination.
Some have called such operations assassinations. They are not. And the use of that loaded term is misplaced. Assassinations are unlawful killings. Here, for the reasons that I have given, the U.S. government's use of lethal force in self-defense against a leader of al-Qaeda or an associated force who presents an imminent threat of violent attack would not be unlawful.
Not unlawful. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, is with us, the national head of the ACLU. What was the legal justification for these killings that the Attorney General laid out, Mr. Romero?
Well, we'd love to know. In fact, that's the focus of our lawsuit using the Freedom of Information Act. And we use FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, as an X-ray of our democracy. We want to focus on what's going on behind the closed doors of government. It's a way to know exactly what the government is thinking and doing. And so we've used FOIA to get the legal memoranda that justify this targeted killing program. Justice Department and the Obama administration have fought us tooth and nail for those legal memos. And what's remarkable here, I mean, let's first pull the camera back and look at this a little bit farther back. You have the president and the attorney general talking at length about the targeted killing program. They talk about it in generalities. They talk about it in terms of its existence. They crow over it when they get one of the bad guys, and so they want to show themselves to be tough on the war on terror. And so they talk about the targeted killings program, and they give this tremendous speech at great length framing some of the issues. In court, they won't even confirm or deny the existence of the program. It's almost Orwellian. It's like what we say in court can be a different language than what we say in the public. They won't even confirm or deny the existence of the targeted killing drone program. They refuse to provide the legal rationale they've used to place people on these lists. They refuse to confirm or deny that the programs are the one that the targeted killing program is the one that, in fact, has been targeting individuals like Mr. al-Awlaki. And you have this complete doublespeak of saying this program is so secret and so inherently important to national security that we won't discuss it in court. But we'll give a speech about it, and we'll do interviews with the press about it. And so it's this enormous irony of saying, We'll tell you just enough to make you feel good that we're taking the war on terror seriously. But we won't tell the judicial branch enough about this targeted killing program to show you that we're doing it right.
During the Bush administration, there were any number of memos that were written to give us explicit, detailed legal justification for steps that were taken. Now, those were hotly debated once they became public, the rationale in some of those, but they were there. Do those exist in this administration? Does President Obama have something more detailed than what his attorney general laid out last week?
Well, I don't know for a fact because they won't confirm or deny the existence of such memos. We believe it to be true that the memos exist, which is why we're asking them for the legal architecture, the rationale, the way in which they argue that you can have due process without judicial process. So let's look at the law. Let's look at the cases they cite. Let's look at how they want to establish these new legal precedents so we can kick the tires on it. And without being able to be assured and assuaged that these legal principles are, in fact, in keeping with established law, we're just being asked to trust the government. I mean, Jonathan is right in that. The Attorney General is telling us exactly what Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Ashcroft told us. Trust us. We're doing the right thing.
Anthony Romero, national head of the ACLU, please stand by there in New York. When we return, Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School joins us. He was in the Bush administration and says, as tough as some of this stuff looks, there is a kind of checks, new kind of checks and balance ecology growing up around it. Listeners, what do you think? Did you hear Attorney General Eric Holder's speech last week? Did you read it? Is there an adequate legal justification there for these killings? Are you surprised, amazed that Barack Obama has pushed forward with the same measures, same rationale as George W. Bush here, after all Obama's earlier criticism, must we accept a president's trust me justification? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. Talking about justice and war, this is Tom Ashbrook and On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the Obama administration's case for extraordinary targeted killings, even of Americans, in the war on terror, Obama, Bush, the Constitution, and the limits of executive power here. You can join the conversation this hour. Is due process what a president says it is? And what about courts and precedent and law? What future are we opening up here? Is this necessary, given the threats to the nation that we've seen acted on that are out there right now? How do you see the president's actions, this administration's actions, in the context of the global situation and in the context of the American Constitution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go back just a little bit here to President Obama. This was a big speech he gave on national security in 2009 at the National Archives in Washington, where the U.S. Constitution itself, the original, is kept, copy of it there. And he said, in the first years after 9/11, the Bush administration and much of the country went off course, said Barack Obama, President Obama there, lost its moral and legal compass then.
All too often, our government made decisions based on fear rather than foresight. That all too often, our government trimmed facts and evidence to fit ideological predispositions. Instead of strategically applying our power and our principles, too often we set those principles aside as luxuries that we could no longer afford. And during this season of fear, too many of us, Democrats and Republicans, politicians, journalists, and citizens, fell silent.
The president in 2009. Here, his Attorney General Eric Holder last week at Northwestern University Law School, about the situation now, saying that Americans could be proud of how this administration struggles morally and toils over the law books before it orders the killings last fall of Americans.
Any decision to use lethal force against a United States citizen, even one intent on murdering Americans and who has become an operational leader of al-Qaeda in a foreign land, is among the gravest that government leaders can face. The American people can be and deserve to be assured that actions taken in their defense are consistent with their values and their laws.
Eric Holder last week giving his rationale, or some of it, what he was willing to share on current policy there. Anthony Romero is with us, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, joining us from New York. And with me in the studio, Jack Goldsmith is here. Let's bring him in now. He served in the Bush administration as U.S. Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, and before that as Special Counsel to the Department of Defense, now a professor of law at Harvard. He's out with a new book called Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11. You can read an excerpt, by the way, at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack Goldsmith, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
So Americans have really struggled to get their heads around this. You've watched everybody do that, and now here we are in a new administration, 3 years into a new administration, and a lot of these things are still going on. There have been changes along the way, and you describe those in your book, and you say that a new kind of ecology of constraint has grown up around the president, whatever rationale is given, whatever we see in exactly how due process is defined. So as I read you, you're saying, look, there's a big threat out there. There are constraints here. Let's not worry quite so much.
Right. Well, it's okay to worry. I think that worry is important because worry of the type that Mr. Romero and his organization has done in the last decade is good for the presidency. But I do think I agree that that he leaves a lot out of the story when he talks about the targeted killing episode and the attorney general's speech. For one thing, Mr. Romero's organization brought a lawsuit challenging the very targeted killing that he's complaining about now. And a judge in that lawsuit ruled that the Constitution gave the president, left the decision whether to kill even an American citizen on the battlefield to Congress and the president and not to the courts. And that the judge, in effect, said that the due process would come from within the political branches.
Anthony Romero?
I'm sorry.
Not at all.
May I call you Jack? I don't mean to.
Yes, please do.
Okay, Jack. And please call me Anthony.
Okay.
I mean, I appreciate that. And it's true that we brought the lawsuit on behalf of Mr. Alaki's father. Where perhaps I think there might be a point to clarify and punctuate. The court, the judge there bounced our lawsuit out because the father didn't have standing to bring the case on behalf of the son. So actually the case was dismissed because Mr. Alaki is an adult and his father brought this case on behalf of his adult son, and the court found that the father lacked standing to bring the case on behalf of a fully formed adult U.S. citizen. The court did go on to talk about the political question which you referenced, but that wasn't the terms in which the case was dismissed. In fact, it leaves a very open question now about whether or not, if you find the proper party withstanding, whether or not you can raise the political question again. I don't think it's by any means resolved. We did bring the lawsuit, and we did lose, but it was for, I think, a primary different reason, the one you referred to.
Jack Goldsmith, let me put this in terms that our listeners are very closely paying attention here. Here's one Sterling, why Sterling writes, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, you know it well, provides that, in quoting it, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Life, liberty, or property. The Sixth that says that there should be speedy and public trial. A listener writes, allowing the president the power to be investigator, judge, and jury, acting in secret is to invite tyranny. That far-off sound you hear is James Madison spinning in his grave. What do you say?
What I say to that is that, as the attorney general said, what process is due depends on the circumstances. And there's a much broader context in which one has to understand the targeted killing here. First of all, no administration, as the attorney general said, likes the idea of killing an American citizen. I mean, it's clearly something they would not have liked to have done. But there was all sorts of legal support and a legal framework around what they did, starting with the Congress's authorization and definition of this war back in 2001, which was recently reaffirmed by Congress, starting with many judicial habeas corpus decisions that define the scope of the conflict and who comes within the authorized conflict. There's an elaborate process within the executive branch, and then there's elaborate oversight by Congress in the intelligence committees and the armed services committees. And finally, we know more details in the press because the press has done such an extraordinary job of finding out what's going on in secret. We know more details about this decision and how it was made and what the legal authorities were than probably any American president's legal decision to engage in a targeted killing in the past. So there's a large, well-settled and framework of law behind what the president did.
What does that leave you wanting then, Anthony Romero? I mean, it's hard for lay people when you've got a Harvard law professor and the head of the ACLU
right.
with such a canyon between them on whether this is fine
right.
or
well,
this
really
is a terrible fundamental breach of the Constitution.
There really isn't that much of a canyon. I read Jack's book, and I really do commend it to everyone. Every card-carrying member of the ACLU should go out and buy this book. It's a brilliant analysis of what transpired. I think it is as thorough as anything I've ever read. I think it's one of the top books I've read on the 9/11. I've read them all. And I think Jack provides a very thorough analysis of what little has changed and why. And there are a couple places where I demur, but I don't think it's a canyon. First, let me just say, I think part of the trouble that I have, and that perhaps Jack and I depart immediately, is a philosophical one, if you will, whether or not we are at war. And the question is the authorization of the use of military force. This is unlike any other war we've ever fought. This is an endless, everywhere war. This is anywhere the government chooses, whether it's in Yemen, where we don't have an official declaration of war, and it's endless. It's not going to be like World War II or Vietnam. And so the questions that normally we debate as individuals who study the law is, during wartime, what are you willing to give up? But if this is an endless everywhere war, we're talking about a new normal. That's Jack's, I think it's in your first or second chapter, Jack, you use that as the title of your chapter. I think it's exactly right. It's a new normal. It will forever define how we think about American power and American military force everywhere and forever. And that's where the concerns come in. And from there, we depart on talking about the ecosystem. And I love the analysis, and Jack, you give us so much credit in terms of the public interest bar and your analysis of CCR's work on Guantanamo and my own organization's work on FOIA is very much appreciated. But I think the ecosystem is not it's not thriving. I think it's an ecosystem that is very frail.
Jack Goldsmith, can you describe that for those who haven't seen the book? I mean, what is it? I read you describing it as kind of the presidency as a kind of Gulliver and lots of threads thrown over right. that president, that executive power holding it down. But, you know, for Americans, I think a lot of people look at it and say, well, the Constitution is supposed to be that. The courts are supposed to be that. But describe what you right. see as these elements of constraint on a very empowered presidency.
Right. I don't deny that the president has enormous powers, maybe more power than ever before. And I agree with Anthony that this is an indefinite war, and it is problematic that the president will exercise war powers on an indefinite basis. These are all things to be concerned about. What I try to describe in the book is what's been overlooked, and that is that these presidential war powers, and one of the main reasons that Obama continued Bush's policies is because these presidential war powers have been fully vetted by Congress, by the courts, by the press, which got inside the executive branch like never before and revealed what it was doing, and it was responsible for a lot of the pushback against the Bush presidency, by organizations like the ACLU, which have done an extraordinary job in bringing freedom of information lawsuits to reveal things about what's going on inside the government. Obama is not acting in an unconstrained way. He didn't want to do a lot of things he wanted to do. He was pushed to do them because there was a consensus, legal and political, behind what he was doing.
That there was a threat and these were appropriate responses.
And
when you say vetted, what do you mean today? I mean, we thought that vetted meant, all right, this will be tested against the language of our Constitution. And when you say vetted, you seem to mean something different, something more amorphous.
Well, it's a lot of this war. This war has been more vetted by courts than any war in American history by a very large margin. The fact is that the courts in reviewing Guantanamo Bay have reached into and restricted the president and forced the president to show up and explain himself more than ever before. And moreover, the precedents generated by those lawsuits are the precedents that both empower and constrain the president, and even in things like targeted killing. When the administration looks to who it can go after abroad, it looks to those judicial precedents and tries to stay inside of them.
And such that they exist.
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, Jack. I don't mean to.
No, please. Let,
go ahead.
Such as they exist. I mean, part of where I think we differ and is the fact that the pushback that Jack describes, I mean, I call it pushback, the vigorousness of the engagement from the press and the public and the courts, I find rather anemic. I mean, frankly, Congress did not stop the torture program, nor did it stop the rendition program, nor did it stop the warrantless wiretapping program. Members of Congress have been happy cheerleaders on the abridgment of basic civil liberties and civil rights. And so Congress, unfortunately, has played much more of a rubber stamp role. There are some individuals, which you note in your book, like Jane Harman and others, who really did delve into the issues much more deeply. But by and large, Congress was not a vigorous proponent. I actually say that Congress emasculated itself in this process by deferring so much to the executive branch. And then you look at the courts. It is true that some of the great cases that have been used, especially the Supreme Court, have reached in to make sure that due process protections adhere to the defendants at Guantanamo. But let's also look at the fact the courts have bounced out of their courts. The judges have bounced out of their courts. Any case brought by any individual who was tortured by the American government, there has yet to be seen one individual who was waterboarded or tortured and see that case even brought with the evidence in front of it. The courts just say, oh, no, state secrets, too sensitive, we bounce it out. There's been no victim of torture who's had his day in court. And we can go down the list. Mr. Al-Masri.
Mm-hmm.
The Jeppesen defendants, they haven't had their day in court.
Still and waiting. If I may, I want to get our listeners in before too long here. Anthony Romero, please stand by, New York, and Jack Goldsmith with me right here. Here's one online. Pat says, Eric Holder claims that due process is distinct from judicial process. He also must think we're idiots, Pat writes. Austin's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Austin, thanks. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. What do you think, Austin?
I feel that the targeted killing, as some are calling it, I believe it's totally justified on an American citizen because that American citizen was killed on foreign soil in, the gentleman said, a unconventional war zone. It is a war zone. So if the American government came and assassinated me on American soil, I would be upset about it. But if I was a terrorist on foreign soil, even being an American citizen, I wouldn't be too upset about it because I feel that judicial due process is not needed. If I am an American citizen and I turn my back on my country and I go anywhere in the world to try to assist somebody else in killing an American, I feel the American government has full right to target me.
Austin, we've got it loud and clear. Let us hold that for a moment and get another view right here. Susie in Columbus, Ohio. Susie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks. Thanks for talking about Obama's illegal assassinations. I totally disagree with the last caller. And I agree with Anthony Romero that there's no due process without testing the so-called evidence in courts, and that the Obama administration is claiming the right to assassinate even on American soil. So we've lost our democratic republic, I really believe. And they not only murdered al-Awlaki, but they later, in a separate attack, assassinated his 16-year-old son without ever having to get an independent court to verify the evidence. And so I think that the greatest threat to us is unchecked government power, not that the trade-off between safety and due process is a false trade-off, that you can't be secure if you have a dictatorship, and that I've been very disappointed with the press because the so-called liberal press has not covered this because they've been, you know, obsessing about Romney's gaffes or Limbaugh's, you know, insanity.
Susie, we're on it right now. Our time is short before the break. Jack Goldsmith, a couple of things here. One, yes, Al-Awlaki's son was killed. That was described as, you know, unintentional, collateral damage here. What about Austin's point about it being abroad? Where is the line? What does an American citizen have to do to become vulnerable to a drone strike from the sky?
According to the Attorney General, and I basically agree with his analysis, the government, the person has to pose a very serious threat. The person has to come within the war that Congress has authorized. And just to say to Anthony, we are in a war. The courts and Congress have both said that, and the president believes that.
This is the global war on terror.
It's the war against al-Qaeda and its affiliates, and it's defined that way. It's limited that way. There are certain things, many things that the government can't do. But the main thing, in addition to being a member of the enemy defined by Congress and to being a serious threat, another condition is that the government, the threat has to be imminent, and the government must not have any other feasible means of redressing the threat. Al-Awlaki was behind both the Detroit bombings and the New York bombings.
It's called underwear bombing.
The underwear bombings. Mm-hmm. And he was plotting to commit other attacks. And the president of the United States has a responsibility, consistent with his legal authorities, to keep the country safe. And that's what he did.
Here we are in 2012, all these years after the Constitution is laid out, and wondering where exactly we are headed in a time when this war, described as unending. Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School, author of Power and Constraint, the Accountable Presidency After 9/11. Please stand by. And Anthony Romero, head of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, with us from New York. Listeners, you can join us. Has a decade of debate and pushback effectively constrained the president or not? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Obama administration's case for extraordinary targeted killings, even of Americans, in the war on terror, on al-Qaeda. Obama, we're looking at here, Bush, the Constitution, and the limits of executive power in a time like these. Anthony Romero is with us, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, and with me in the studio, Jack Goldsmith, now professor at Harvard Law School. He was in the Bush Defense Department, in the Bush Justice Department, in the thick of all this. He's written a new book, Power and Constraint, the Accountable Presidency After 9/11, argues there that a lot of pushback from Americans at all levels has, in effect, put effective constraints on the president. Anthony Romero calls a lot of that anemic. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Has a decade of debate and pushback effectively constrained the U.S. president in this environment? Or does it look like anything goes or too much goes? Is all this necessary, these steps for effective war on al-Qaeda? Pushback, is this eroding fundamental rights? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here's a little bit just of the arc of it. This was September 17, 2001. President Bush responding bluntly when asked by a reporter if he wanted Osama bin Laden dead.
I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
Wanted dead or alive, and that spirit was very much alive at that time. Of course, Osama bin Laden stayed quite alive as well, ultimately taken in the Obama administration. But President Obama had been a sharp critic of the Bush administration. In a 2009 speech after he came into office, he outlined his national security doctrine, he said. Say it was time to rein in excesses.
The decisions that were made over the last 8 years established an ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable. A framework that failed to rely on our legal traditions and time-tested institutions, and that failed to use our values as a compass. And that's why I took several steps upon taking office to better protect the American people.
To better protect, to rein in. But you've got a threat, and you've got legal imperatives, constitutional imperatives. Candidate Ron Paul, not too happy about that killing of Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen in September last year. Here he is saying, you've got a dangerous precedent.
If the American people accept this blindly and casually, that we now have an accepted practice of the president assassinating people who he thinks are bad guys, I think it's sad. I think what would the people have said about Timothy McVeigh? We didn't assassinate him. They were pretty certain that he had done it. They went and put him through the courts, and they executed him. But to start assassinating American citizens without charges, we should think very seriously about this.
Ron Paul on the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki. Jack Goldsmith and Anthony Romero are here. David in Orlando, Florida is calling. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. What is it to stop a foreign power from coming to U.S. and killing one of their citizens that they consider a terrorist or a threat? When we do the same, we have no legal means to stop it, or we have no moral high ground.
Jack Goldsmith?
The answer to that is quite simple. Those nations aren't at war with anyone in our country. But moreover, we don't...
Though they could be. It's a hypothetical.
Let's assume that they are. That we don't claim the authority. The United States does not claim the authority to be able to kill anyone anywhere. The Attorney General was quite clear to limit it to places that are effectively ungoverned, where the government itself cannot take steps to stop the threat. That's clearly not true in the United States.
So that would be the American pushback in that case. You hear, you know, David's concern about where does this go. Ron in Enfield, Connecticut. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment that I'm very troubled by these actions that the government has taken, and I'm especially troubled since I'm a first-year law student at Western New England University. And the fact that they won't release these memoranda that supposedly justify, you know, things like the targeted killings in the NDAA, it just kind of blows my mind, because if I can't answer a question in class and say, you know, yes or no, I have to justify my reasoning and my rationale.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not doing the same thing, it's just, I just don't have words for it.
Ron, I appreciate your call. Anthony Romero, a first-year law student there, wondering how the principles we're operating on here can be tested if they're not fully articulated. There was a speech last week, but many people said, boy, there's a lot that still in full deep legal terms is not laid out here.
Well, stick with us, because we need your help to make sure that we get it right. I mean, and the confusion is there in all parts. It's not just because he's a one-year law student. It's because we're not getting the full facts. The quote you had of Eric Holder in his speech, where you said, the American people can and deserve to be assured that actions taken in their defense are consistent with their values and their laws. That's what you ran the clip.
Mm-hmm.
The next line was my favorite, though. So he continues. So although I cannot discuss or confirm any particular program or operation, I believe it's important to explain these legal principles publicly. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, it's amazing. And what Jack just said about, I'm skimming through the Holder speech here, Jack, and so I'm just doing it quickly, but you said that the government would only could go after someone where the country is ungovernable. I don't find that in Eric Holder's speech.
Well, he did say a number of things. Maybe we should look at them. I mean, he has said that killing an American citizen requires that citizen poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States.
That's a separate issue. Right?
Well, but then the capture is not feasible. I guess you could relate that to the environment they're living in. That the target has military value, that other people are not targeted intentionally around that target, that the potential collateral damage not be excessive, and that the weapons used will not inflict unnecessary suffering. I mean, there are parameters there, Anthony Romero, though.
But it goes on. It says, whether a capture of a U.S. citizen is feasible is a fact-specific and potentially time-sensitive question. It may depend, among other things, whether capture can be accomplished in the window of time available to prevent an attack without undue risk to civilians or to U.S. personnel. I mean, it's not curtailed the way that Jack described it. I mean, I would like it to be. I would hope it to be.
Jack?
The Attorney General says, in addition to everything that Tom just said, he also says that the country in question has to be unwilling or unable to take care of the threat, and that's an international law standard. May I say, we need to back up a little bit, mm-hmm, and put this in perspective. This president has – I agree that more legal analysis can and should be disclosed, but let's not be – Let's put in perspective how much has been disclosed. We don't typically, in a war, scrutinize a president's targeting decisions in this way. This is a fully authorized, legitimate war by Congress. Never before has a decision had this much scrutiny before. Americans have been targeted and killed in past wars, in the Civil War and in World War II as well. Nothing like this kind of scrutiny has ever occurred before, and there's an inevitable push for more and more and more scrutiny. The government's in a difficult position. It's trying. I really do think that the Obama administration is trying to be as candid as it can. But this is still technically a covert operation, which is regulated by congressional statute. There are representations made, complicated, classified representations made to the governments abroad about how much the government can acknowledge about what it's doing. So the government's trying to walk a fine line between disclosing to the American people and carrying out its national security responsibilities.
But Jack, what if they got it wrong? I mean, let's take the most extreme hypothetical. What if they got it wrong? What if their facts are wrong? What if their evidence is wrong?
It's possible that the facts would be wrong.
How would we know?
It's also possible that the facts would be wrong if it went to court. Courts make mistakes as well.
I understand,
and
there is a trade-off.
There is a trade-off in war, and mistakes are made. And there's no doubt that no one in the Obama administration, I'm confident, wants there to be mistakes, but mistakes will be made.
But let me be clear.
Anthony Romero?
I mean, if they got it wrong, and remember, we had over 700 people held at Guantanamo who were the worst of the worst, according to George Bush. Half of them have been released. And many of them, we now know, had no ties to terrorism. They were the result of bounty hunters. We had no evidence that they were the worst of the worst. So we had a 50% batting average, at best, of the detainees at Guantanamo. And if we get it wrong with an American citizen overseas, think of it as if it's my son my godson, my government killing an American citizen, not in an active theater of war. I mean, we're at war in the theaters
of
war.
Would you be okay if it were an active theater of war?
It would be very different.
Because I think that's a false distinction. The fact is that the active theater of war is where the enemy defined by Congress is found. And there are all sorts of legal limitations on when we can go. Texas for
how about northern Mexico?
For reasons we just discussed, Texas and northern Mexico would not be possible.
Well, why not? If we're talking about this war
northern
on
Mexico,
you call a fully justified, legitimate.
Exactly. Because as the Attorney General said, if there's a feasible means of picking up the person and using the criminal process, that will be used and should be used consistent with the process.
Northern Mexico.
That would not apply
northern
to
Mexico,
some parts of northern Mexico.
I don't know what the situation is in northern Mexico.
Well, we know
there are parts of northern Mexico that
If the Mexican government were harboring terrorists and governance had broken down and those terrorists were threatening the United States with attacks like the Detroit bombing, I do think the president would be authorized to use force there. There would be political constraints as well.
It's astonishing.
But it may be astonishing, but it's what the law permits.
Anthony Romero, how does this not roll our Constitution out the door? Because there's so much that's taken out of the fabric of precedent and legal argument here. Well,
it's not taken out of the fabric of precedent. There are judicial precedents that say in World War II and in 2004 that say that the president's war powers do not change just because an American citizen is involved. Now, those cases involve detention, and those cases involve military commissions. But the same principle applies here. Presidents in wartime have discretion to target members of the enemy. This president's discretion is much more constrained in doing that by lawyers, by Congress, and by the press than any president in American history.
Anthony, do you agree?
No. I mean, obviously, we're endeavoring to constrain it, Jack, but I don't think it is constrained. And I think, frankly, the analysis I make about northern Mexico is not a far-fetched one. I was just on the U.S.-Mexican border in August of this year. There are parts where FBI agents get shot on the other side of the border. We can't extradite the drug cartels. They have travel advisories from the State Department saying, do not travel to these cities in part of northern Mexico. The government cannot control that part of northern Mexico. And it's breathtaking to imagine that we could be able to execute drones, to deploy drones, to get those individuals who could be terrorists now, tomorrow they could be drug cartels.
No. The Congress, let me be clear. The president does not have the authority to go after any terrorist or any criminal in the world that's ungoverned. This is a very limited authorization that's tied to 9/11 and al-Qaeda and its associates.
But let's talk about imminent for a second, because one of the things that I think is very troubling is that they say they got up Mr. Alaki.
An imminent threat of violent
attack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fact that they put him on a watch list months and months and months before they actually killed him makes the point of imminence a little bit difficult to understand. What if Mr. Alaki, after first planning, let's say, the Detroit bombing, had a Saul on the road to Damascus conversion moment and decided he wanted to be the most upstanding, wonderful human being that he could be after he found his way, redemption. And then he's still on a list 6 months later, but he's no longer an imminent threat because let's say he gave up the ghost. How do we know that it undercuts the whole idea that he's an imminent threat when you can place him on a list and kill him 6 months later. More immediate.
Let me go to Peter in Waterloo, Iowa. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Once again, a fantastic conversation. Excuse my ignorance, but maybe your guests and you can help me with this. Some time ago, I read an article in the New Yorker, and it was analyzing Cheney and Addington's relationship and how the two of them got together and systematically tried to beef up the executive branch because Cheney had some issues stemming way back to Watergate with Nixon.
Yeah, yeah.
And when this war hit, Cheney went berserk, got with Addington, and your other guest's name, he keeps quoting the Congress and everything being so vetted. But all of this was just a steamroller by Cheney and Addington and others. And if that could be part of the conversation,
show. The time is short. But there was a view, and the vice president then, Dick Cheney, had a view of a much stronger presidency being desirable. But where does that leave us, Chuck? I mean, Turley, we mentioned Turley. Yeah, he says, what Holder's describing is a model of an imperial presidency that would have made Richard Nixon blush.
That is just such hyperbole.
First
of all, it was the reaction to the early Bush policies led by Richard Cheney that led to the judicial involvement and the press involvement and the congressional involvement and the internal executive branch watchdog involvement that led to a clear evolution over the course of the Bush administration that legitimized the policies over time after it changed them, pushed back on some of them, changed some of them little, some of them it didn't change at all. Just about all of them were blessed. That's what Obama inherited.
How do we keep a fundamental understanding of what our rights are if we have an unending war here and due process is effectively whatever the president says it is, and even the rationale around what he says it is, we're not shown? How do we sustain? Let's say this, it's already more than 10 years. Let's say it's 20. Let's say it's 30. You know, when are the lines just erased?
I really don't think that they're erased at all. It may seem like that they are, but they're not. You see the president acting. What you don't see is all the ways that he's not acting and all the constraints that go into what he can and can't do. And the fact is that precisely because this is an indefinite and unusual war, the other systems are, the courts are much, much more involved. We've become so used to judicial review of the president's military actions, time and time again, sometimes agreeing with them, sometimes not, that we've forgotten the fact that this hardly has ever happened in American history, that the press has disclosed secret after secret, that Anthony's organization can go to the government, to courts, and extract 150,000 pages of secret information. Nothing like this has ever happened before. This is all part of the accountability system that has grown up to check and watch this presidency. But let me say, the final point is, what I'm saying is not a reason to be complacent. And it's very important that organizations like Mr. Romero, like Anthony's and others, continue to push at and demand more and more transparency. That is part of the system of legitimizing what the president is doing.
Anthony Romero, are you looking to legitimize what the president is doing? We just got a minute. What are the stakes here for Americans watching this?
The stakes are too high. And the fact is that the president has not changed the policies from those of George Bush in any real substantial way, where Jack and I do agree. The reason why he's not changed them, we disagree. They've not changed them because, first off, the president didn't have the courage to prosecute those who broke the law. So his unwillingness to go after the accountability piece, letting individuals who sanction torture, the highest levels of government, it's very hard to change the battleship when you don't agree that something was wrong. Second of all, pure politics. Who cares about this set of issues? It's a bunch of 170 guys in orange jumpsuits at Guantanamo. They don't vote. If this were a constituency attached to women or choice or gays and lesbians, and I speak as an openly gay man, it would be different. It's pure politics by this president.
And stakes for our constitutional governance?
They're too high.
Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, thank you for joining us today from New York, Mr. Romero.
My pleasure.
Jack Goldsmith, author of Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11, professor at Harvard Law School. Professor Goldsmith, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt of that book at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.